You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast. 20 Minutes with Dan Wells.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for Brian and I to sit down with the remarkable talents that so generously concede to sitting down with us for a while, and we get to discuss their craft, how they do what they do, how they come up with ideas, what they do with them once they get them, and generally explore that process of turning raw inspiration into literary gold, which of course is always our intent here.
Most definitely.
So, yes, absolutely. Yes.
And someday we may actually do it in 20 minutes.
I don't think that's ever going to happen. No. Because Brian, our guest host...
They're just too damn awesome.
They are. And check this one out. All right?
Okay. All right. Lay it down for me.
Dear friends, just a general public service. If you are a sci-fi / fantasy fanatic and you're married... and you're contemplating procreation, then this is going to be the episode for you, because in all likelihood, your child is going to grow up to be today's guest host. All right? He grew up in Utah, where as a child, he was fed no food at all. Instead, he was taught to subsist purely on a diet of fantasy and science fiction fed to him by his parents. Now, it should come as no surprise that he haunted the local library like a ghoul, devouring all of the fantasy novels, then all of the sci-fi, and then the historical and the classical literature, eventually transforming that fine civic structure into the literary equivalent of a desiccated corpse. And now, here's the fascinating thing. He didn't read a lot of horror during this time, and yet... horror stalked him like a cold shadow of doom. Everything he tried to write turned dark. He tried dragging his stories into the light, and they screamed, "No, no," until he finally cut them loose and they scurried back into the inky depths from whence they came. And finally, a good friend urged him to accept and embrace his doomed and damned existence and just write a damned horror book. And thus, dear friends, was the John Cleaver series was born, which currently is comprised of I Am Not a Serial Killer, Mr. Monster, and I Don't Want to Kill You. He's also written Partials, a YA thriller sci-fi tale set in a dark future. Are you picking up on a theme here? Also, A Night of Blacker Darkness, which is a farcical vampire tale, which by all accounts seems to be read like a collaboration between Molière and Rice and Terry Pratchett. I have not read this book, but I am so going to. The Hollow City, another psychological thriller, separate from the John Cleaver series, came out July 3rd and is available at all the usual places. His work has been nominated for the Hugo and the Nebula. He's also, of course, one of the hosts of the Parsec Award-winning Writing Excuses, along with Mary Cowell, Howard Tyler, and Brandon Sanderson. He's a theater geek and a game geek, which makes him the ideal specfic writer. Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in welcoming to the round table Mr. Dan Wells. Dan, please take the big chair, and thank you so much for making time in your schedule to sit down and talk with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Was that a fair assessment with poetic license allowed for the background that brought you to your current state?
That was. That was very accurate, I think, in all points. Except I am not Nebula nominated.
Really? No. Okay. Just the Hugo.
Hugo and Campbell, but not Nebula.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for that.
But I did especially like the part about how your children can grow up to become me. That maybe will have people not listen, unfortunately. But
well, you know, that's the beauty of the podosphere. Once it's out there, it stays out there. So for all eternity, this could be a cautionary tale for fantasy and sci-fi geek parents.
Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be horror writers.
There will be a sudden downturn in the population.
That's right. That's right. Or an upswing. Who knows?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's not bandy mince words or bandy about anymore. I'm going to make note of the time, and let's start our 20 minutes with Mr. Dan Wells. Dan, there are writers that strike me as very driven writers. When you read their work, when you see what they do and how they do it, it's very clear that their commitment to their craft goes beyond just a mere profession. And I think it's, for me, that's very clear that you are one of those individuals. And I'm just curious, and this may seem like an odd question, but do you have, when you are writing, not an agenda, but is there a message, or is there something that you feel that you are putting forth in your work that's unique to you? Does that make it all any kind of sense?
It does make sense. Okay. And the answer is yes, but I'm not sure what.
Okay.
I've said many times that I don't write for an audience. You know, I have adult thrillers, I have YA books, and I don't write necessarily for that market. I always just am writing for myself. And if people want to read it, then hooray, that's awesome. But I, as rude as this sounds, I don't have you in mind when I'm writing. I'm always just writing whatever I think is really interesting. And so everything that I publish is, I think, very intrinsically me for that reason.
But
whatever that says about me, I don't know if you want to own that, but there it is.
But speaking from during that creative froth, when you're sitting down at the keyboard and pounding away at that first draft, is, yes, you're not, and I agree that you don't write for an audience, but is there someone that you're writing to? Is there, friends, I'm sorry. This is kind of weird, out there philosophical stuff. But I thought if anybody could walk me through this, it might be Dan. Is there someone that you're writing to, do you think, as you put together these words and characters and plot arcs?
I don't know.
Okay.
I sometimes, and this is a very interesting question. I do sometimes think about specific people as I'm writing. I will occasionally finish a scene or be halfway through a scene and think, oh, my editor's going to hate this one. or I wrote a scene just a couple of weeks ago and it for the sequel to Partials, which is called Fragments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Partials as a YA had a little kind of side plot romance in it. And I've gotten so much feedback about how they wanted more. People wanted far more romance than I put into the first one. And so I finished a scene and thought, oh, this one is just going to tick those people off so much when this scene finally sees the light of day.
Okay.
No, really, most of the time when I'm writing, it's, I suppose you could say I am directing it toward my past self. I will write a scene and think, yes, finally, this scene's been written. I've always wanted to see this, and no one's ever done it. Or I'll think, this particular combination of ideas is something I've been waiting for ever since I outlined this book 3 months ago. Yay, I finally got it down. Maybe that.
Okay. It's a curiosity for me because I think everybody's writing process, and by that I mean when you are deep into that crafting mode, is different and unique. And I think some of us are writing to someone, maybe not to an audience, but that there's some sort of muse or I don't know, some sort of daemon in the Greek sense that we're appealing to as we write. So thank you for indulging me in that very bizarre question.
Oh, no problem at all. If there and is maybe some deeper force out there that is just delighted by whatever I'm writing, I don't know if I ever want to meet it.
Indeed, indeed.
And just as a quick little sidestep along the same lines, do you find that you think about if you're getting into the technical aspect of something and you're not quite sure if you have it right, does that ever hold you up, or do you blaze past it and worry about it later? How do you deal with those little pieces?
It depends. If it's a question that is really bugging me, I'll have to stop what I'm doing and try to answer it.
Okay.
Like how to do, for example, in a book that I'm about halfway finished with, this manuscript, I had a scene where some people assaulted a factory. They wanted to steal several trucks from this factory. And I didn't know exactly how to do that or what would be the best way. So I happened to be friends with Larry Correa, who knows this kind of stuff backwards and forwards. So I sent him an email and said, you have to help me. I can't finish this scene until I know. How many guys would you take? What kind of weapons would they be armed with? All of these kind of things. And then he, of course, sent me back 10 pages of detailed notes on exactly how to mount an assault on a factory. So
that's awesome.
But then on and with geography, that's another one that I have to stop. I write a lot of my books with Google Maps open right next to me so that I can look at it and know exactly where people are going and why and how. And I want to make sure that I get that right. But other questions don't concern me nearly as much, and I don't know why. Maybe they're just not as interesting to me, but I'm willing to gloss over them and just, yeah, we'll pretend like there's like this works. And I'll fix it later if I have to.
Very cool.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
Brian, you had a very cool question we were talking about earlier.
Sure, it kind of goes along the same lines a little bit. In I Am Not a Serial Killer, John Cleaver is a sociopath, yeah? Mm-hmm. And with characters like Dexter, and then there's a BBC version of Sherlock Holmes where Sherlock definitely has sociopathic elements to him. More characters seem to be cropping up with kind of diagnosable social abnormalities, and it's I don't want to say it's a trend, but it makes a very intriguing character. And so one of the questions that I have in terms of molding and creating that character is, for you, what challenges did you encounter in constructing John Cleaver, and how do you make a character with such a social challenge likable to a general audience?
That is the major challenge, and I knew that going into it when I was first discussing the idea with my writing group, is making this person likable, making this person relatable, because the only way a book can work, I think, is if you connect somehow with that main character. And how can you connect with someone who is sociopathic and cannot inherently connect with you? Right. And so I kind of came up with a little list of tricks that I used. And one of them, first of all, was just to make him funny. John Cleaver is funny, and anyone who can make you laugh, you will instantly like them more, just because of the way human beings work.
Good point.
Right.
Another thing I did was I gave him a horrible life, which, again, that's kind of how human beings are wired. We are very social. We want to keep the herd strong so that we can defend ourselves from predators. And so when you see someone as sad and downtrodden as John Cleaver is, you kind of feel sorry for him, and you start to root for him because he's the underdog, and you want him to be happy. And right. So, you know, giving him a broken home and all these other things were just little ways of putting you on his side before we even got into the story. But then the last thing was just, you know, to give him that drive to do what's right, and or what he thought was right, at least. And I find that more than anything else is what people respond to about John, is, you know, the obstacles that he overcomes and that unfailing determination, despite the fact that he is a very dark, potentially horrible person, to always try to find what's right and do what's right, even if he doesn't understand why it's right.
Excellent. Yeah, that's awesome.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Dan Wells after this brief promotional break.
Hi, this is Hugh, the host and editor of the Way of the Buffalo podcast. Twice a month, we present the best short fiction of all genres, thought-provoking interviews, and other diverse entertainments. You can find us online at wayofthebuffalopodcast.blogspot.com or search for us on iTunes. Some people say that short fiction is going the way of the buffalo. Come join us, won't you?
Now let's get back to the conversation with Dan Wells. Dan, let me ask you, and I've asked this of other authors, and I'm curious about your take on it.
Okay.
What do you see the value of spec fic being in the context of culture and society? What do your books add to the world, and you know, yours in specific, and also just the genre in general? What is the plus side, the value of these tales being introduced into the culture?
Well, that's there are a lot of answers to that question.
Yeah.
And the first, and I would say the most important, is that it's cool and I like it. You know?
Absolutely.
We could argue the academics or the psychology or whatever behind this, but at the end of the day, I think the most important thing, what does it add? It adds something awesome. And awesomeness is, you know, kind of what we're going for with art. We want something that will interest you and that will inspire you. And for a vast segment of the population, science fiction, fantasy, and supernatural stuff, that's what they get excited about. And yeah. So, you know, in light of that, I don't think we need any other reasons. I don't think we need to excuse ourselves or apologize for the fact that we write genre fiction.
God, no.
But, you know, going deeper into it, well, I'll go ahead and make up some excuses. Right. Genre fiction allows you to do things in a way that you can't do in any other genre. And a good example is Partials, the science fiction that I just came out with this spring. I wrote it last year, and I put a lot of political stuff into it. You know, the world has ended. There's a few stragglers left over trying to rebuild civilization, but they all have different ideas of how to rebuild it. And given that they're dealing with a very real threat of human extinction, some of those ideas are very extreme. You know, if it comes down to a situation where you could potentially lose the last human beings anywhere, you'll probably go to some pretty extreme lengths to save them.
Sure.
Even if that includes, you know, some repression or some totalitarianism or whatever it is. And so, you know, I was dealing with all of these issues that I thought were very important, and I was seeing, you know, subtle reflections of them through a lot of the stuff that our society is currently going through. You know, how far are we willing to go to stop a terrorist? How many of our own principles are we willing to compromise if it means saving millions of lives?
Sure.
And so, you know, having finished this book and moving on to some other project, then I saw, well, all kinds of stuff happened right at the beginning of this last year. For example, on the very last day of 2011, that is when the president signed the NDAA thing about being able to imprison American citizens without evidence, without justification,
right,
without sentence or trial,
right,
which I think is unconscionably horrible. And I thought, my first thought was, I need to do something about this. I need to say something about this. And then my second thought was, oh, I already wrote a book about this. You know? And so being able to address those kind of topics that I think are very timely and very important, but to do it through the lens of genre fiction so that people on either side of the issue, you know, Partials is not an inherently conservative or liberal book. It's not a political book, and it's not addressing that issue directly, which runs the risk of being very partisan and turning people off.
Sure.
But because it is in this crazy science fictional world that I made up, people on both sides and, you know, every side of that issue can read it and take something away from it in a way that you couldn't without that science fictional element in there.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's my very long-winded
No, that's spot on. That's definitely spot on. And Dan, on a completely different vein, what do you want for your birthday?
What I want for my birthday, there's an old rock band called Half Cocked. They broke up 6 or 7 years ago. I want a reunion concert.
All right, Dan Wells fans, get on that. We want a Half Cocked reunion concert by Dan's birthday.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Indeed.
I, not to totally pull us back 10 minutes, but one of the things that I'm constantly struggling with is how much accuracy is necessary and how much is too much. When you're dealing with things that you're going to have people out there who, the reason that this comes up is that my wife is a special education teacher, and so I've had a lot of experience with people with Asperger's, and other social issues and just a lot of disabilities and things along that line. And there's a character that I'm playing with and that has a disability. And so I'm afraid to even try because I know so many people who are, no matter what I do, are going to point at it and go, oh, that's wrong. Just because of their own personal experiences. Do you put very much stock in that aspect, or do you do research into, the studies of sociopaths or whatever it is that your character has going on? And when you do, where is that line that you draw where you say, okay, I've done enough research, I just need to write the character?
That's it's very touchy ground, especially when you get into something like mental illness. Hollow City, that just came out in July, is about a guy with schizophrenia, and I was very concerned that I was going to portray schizophrenia incorrectly. Mental illness is always skewed in the media. It seems like it's always either demonized or sainted, you'll get, on the one end of the extreme, Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs, who was, basically transsexual, and they managed to turn that, which is very innocent, into this horrifying, terrible, awful thing.
Right.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got people like a movie like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a very fun movie, but it presents mental illness as a lifestyle choice rather than a potentially horrible, disabling affliction. And in a lot of cases, mental illness is awful, and you can't just take that kind of 60s mentality of, oh, they just see the world differently. We can't force them to conform to our rule. Yes, we can, because they need our help, They're suffering through a disease. Yeah. And so I wanted to make sure to present it right and to do it right. And it does, like you said, it hits a point where you have to back off and you realize, I am writing a story about a guy with schizophrenia. I'm not writing a textbook about schizophrenia. And I'm not writing a manual of how to deal with schizophrenia, nor am I writing a scientific paper on what schizophrenia is. I am trying to write, above all else, a cool story that people will like. And if I can get accurate details in addition to that, hooray. But, the story comes first and needs to come first, because that's what really matters. That's what people are there for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Good advice. Yeah.
It's such an interesting thing, because there are some stories that all that they have to do is say that the character is schizophrenic, and I'll buy it. And there's nothing pointing to that character doing anything that tells me that. It's just them stating it. And then there are others where it's so obvious and they never have to state it. And so that just was always something that intrigued me. And I think you answered it really well.
Yeah. And you have to be careful. Because like you said, there are people who will always interpret it either direction. One of the things that I love in Mr. Monster, there's a character named Kurt, who's the kind of jerk boyfriend. And it's really interesting to me that about half the people I talk to who have read the book will say, oh, Kurt was completely unbelievable. Nobody is like that in the real world. And then the other half of the people are like, oh man, I know so many people exactly like her. And so it's just, your own personal experience is going to inform the way you see this. And I've had to learn as an author not to take it personally. Just because you've never met someone like Kurt doesn't mean I wrote the book wrong.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I've run into that. Transcribing actual conversations and then having people tell me that people don't talk that way.
You can't please all the people all the time.
That's right. That's right. Well, cool.
Dan, I wanted to ask you, we recently had Paul Ellard Cooley on, who is another horror writer, a psychological horror author. And yes, it was. It was excellent. And he gave us some keen insights. And with your the canon of work that you have put out there, I'm curious about your tactics regarding not suspense necessarily, but horror in particular. How do you amp up or twist a scene or even a moment in a story into something horrifying, something gut-clenching and breath-catching? How do you, what is it that transforms a moment from a romantic moment or a heroic moment into a horrifying one?
Ooh, good question. What I've found is, just taking whatever is happening in the moment and making sure to emphasize the restrictions involved, you know?
Okay.
If you're talking about, and here I'm recycling an example from writing excuses,
but if
you're talking about how something is sticky, sticky is not scary. But if something makes your fingers stick together, all of a sudden it does become more scary because it's limiting you in some way.
Ah.
If a room is dark, that's not immediately terrifying. But if the room obscures your vision, then it does kind of put you on edge. And so just being very careful with the way you describe something to emphasize that you are limited, that you are restricted, that you don't have as much freedom as you thought, really kind of amps up that fear, because then you start to get a little claustrophobic because your vision is obscured and your fingers are sticking together and whatever else is going on.
Okay.
And so I think that's a nice trick.
Very subtle trick.
Call it a trick,
yeah.
A tactic that people can use.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And what's your standard position on the more visceral horror that is out there? Because clearly you don't shy away from it, but your books are not slash and gore fest books. At what points, how far does Dan Wells go before he says, okay, no, we're not doing that?
Well, in terms of gore, one thing you'll notice in my books is that the gory parts are never the scary parts. And I think that that's true of most fiction.
I had never noticed that. You're right.
You know, when it's kind of the principle of Jaws. You know, once you see the shark, it's not really a scary movie anymore. It's an action movie from that point on.
Okay.
But in the early parts, when you haven't seen the shark and you haven't seen blood flying everywhere, that's when it's scary. And so, you know, I'm more than happy to put body parts and all kinds of stuff into my books because it serves a valuable purpose. But scaring you is not the purpose that it serves. It can do other things like make you uncomfortable, or, you know, it can show you how strong a bad guy is.
Sure.
Or it can show you how creepy a bad guy is. There's a scene in Mr. Monster where he's just walking through the bad guy's house and sees on the stove something nasty sitting in a pan on the stove, and he wonders what that was, and that all by itself, you know, that shows you, well, this guy's really creepy. And then he goes into the back room where there's a torture victim laying there, and we describe that, and it's not scary, but it, in your mind, it builds up, oh, well, you know, the floor is covered with drops of blood. We're not actually seeing the woman get tortured, but we start to imagine in our head, well, what would he have to do to her to get blood to fly that far away?
You invite the reader to engage and fill in the blanks, and their imagination is 100 times better than anything you could write.
Exactly.
Gotcha. That's outstanding.
Yeah.
That's gold, baby. And that's that's also the end of the episode, sadly. The clock...
this flew by. That
it does. It always does. And the sand has not only fallen through the glass, but it's out of the glass and on the floor and making its way out the back. So, yeah, we could do this for hours and hours, which is why we limit ourselves to 20-ish sort of minutes or so.
Right.
So, Dan, thank you so much for taking the time and really offering some vital and valuable insights into the craft.
Seriously.
and so on. That we greatly appreciate that.
Yep. Well, thank you very much for having me. This has been fun.
Yeah, for us too. Ah, good deal. Brian, any final thoughts as we jeté off to the big rap?
I'd be afraid to drum up another 20 minutes.
Yeah,
so
I know.
I'm going to cap it.
Good call. Good call.
But yeah, no, definitely, I think in this episode, you've given me at least massive food for thought in my own writing. So thank you very much for coming on. It was great.
Hey, cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad I was able to help in some way.
Yeah,
definitely. Yes.
And Brian definitely needs your kind of help, Dan.
Yes.
He walks the same dark paths you do. And dear friends, thank you so much for joining us once again. We hope you had as much fun and had as many epiphanies as we did during the process. If you're having a good time, there's always that iTunes rating key. Go out there and hit a star or two. Drop us a comment on the post. We'd love to hear from you there. Or an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. We never get tired of hearing from you guys.
Oh, no.
Stay tuned in a couple of days. We'll be back with Master Wells and a guest writer workshopping a tale and turning still more raw, nascent ideas into golden goodness. Brian, anything our listeners should be doing between now and then?
Now you've set me up to have to, like, conjugate the verb. They should be going and writing, but not...
I had to put you out of your verb comfort zone.
Just go right.
Just go
and
right.
And everything will be right with the world.
That's right. You find what you're looking for, friends, so look for awesome stuff. You will find it. Until a couple of days pass, you guys be cool. We will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.